we launched at a time when the whole internet was so focused on this kind of Twitterification of content, these small bites of content, this constant conversation, this constant buzzing in your ear, which, you know, there is a place for that to a certain extent. But I think in that sort of a climate, a lot of these important stories were, and these sort of quieter, seemingly quieter stories on their surface at least, were being left untold. And so that's where narratively found our opening, and we're still moving forward.
Hello, and welcome to How Things Grow. How Things Grow tells the stories of the people who help companies, technologies, and economic systems take off. Each episode features an interview with one of the leading growth practitioners, entrepreneurs, or experts in the world today. We dive into the stories of these folks. We talk about origins, early victories, strokes of luck, troughs of failure, and much, much more to deconstruct many of the things they do to drive dramatic growth for their companies and technologies. How Things Grow is presented by me, Shamant Rao, the CEO of the mobile user acquisition firm Rocketship HQ.
My guest today is Noah Rosenberg, the founder and CEO of Narratively. Narratively is a publication that I've written for and have also been very, very impressed by for some of the very pioneering work that they've done over the last couple of years. Narratively very much defined a niche for themselves in pioneering long-form human interest journalism in an age of diminishing attention spans. They not only continue to bring out original long-form stories, but have also developed a unique monetization model of a content studio that has helped them thrive in an age when many journalism outlets are facing existential challenges. In this interview, we dive into Noah's journey from being a journalist to a journalism platform creator. We talk about how he validated and launched Narratively and how he saw the demand for long-form human interest stories. We look at what drives audience growth for long-form articles and why they resonate in an age of diminishing attention spans. We dive into Narratively's unique monetization model that has helped keep it both ad-free and allowed its writers to make good money. This is a fascinating interview, and it presents lessons that apply for far beyond long-form journalism. And I'm excited to share with you today.
I'm very excited to welcome Noah Rosenberg, the founder and CEO of Narratively. Noah, welcome to How Things Grow.
Great to be here, Shamant. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I've wanted to have you for a while, especially as I've followed Narratively's journey over the years, Noah. But before Narratively even came into being, you were a journalist. Tell us about your life and career before Narratively came on the horizon.
Yeah, so it seems like a lifetime ago, but certainly the experiences and skills I built up as a journalist continue to have a major impact on me and certainly on the company these days. But I started my career at CBS News right out of college. I was working for a, unfortunately, now defunct division called CBS News Productions, which is essentially an in-house production company within CBS that produced everything from reality series to documentaries to news and politics specials for CBS as well as for outside partners. So I really got to, you know, obtain a very interesting sort of understanding of, you know, the way that the broadcast, you know, news landscape was operating at that time, which was certainly helpful as I went on to build my career. But after a couple of years there, I was sort of getting antsy and really was yearning to be out in the world actually reporting. Whereas at CBS, I was doing largely post-production. I did some production work as well, but it was really largely office-based work, which was an interesting understanding of that side of the process. But I really missed, you know, doing the production and reporting work, which I had gotten to really get an understanding of in college, or at least, you know, the beginning of getting my feet wet in that world. So I took a job at the Queens Courier newspaper group. They hired me as essentially their kind of one-man band, which for me was a dream job. I was, you know, shooting, producing, editing videos, essentially launched their documentary, you know, short documentary film department. I was overseeing their website. I was writing for all their various publications. Ultimately, I would launch and edit a magazine for them, kind of an arts and culture magazine about Long Island City, Queens. And so that, you know, to me, I was there for, you know, about 2.5 maybe a little under 3 years. And, you know, people often ask me, Shamath, if I went to journalism school, and I didn't. I never got a grad degree in journalism, but my stint at the Queen's Courier really I think of as J school, in the sense that I was really doing everything. I got to be, thankfully, sort of a big fish in a small pond, really got to in a borough and a little slice of the world that I think at one point I heard was the most diverse place on earth, with hundreds of languages spoken. There's obviously no shortage of stories. So that was a really interesting time for me. 1 week covering a, you know, multi-part series across multimedia on Holocaust survivors living in Queens. And then a month later, doing a series on immigrant day laborers. A few weeks later, doing a piece on politics or shooting. So it was a really formative time for me. And again, I sort of got that kind of itch after, you know, almost 3 years and wanted to move into kind of bigger spaces. So decided to take a big leap of faith and left my full-time job, which, to be clear, was by no means cushy considering that I was working at a weekly newspaper, but it was had the stability of a full-time job, and left that to go freelance report from South Africa. This was in 2010. I grew up a soccer player, soccer fan. The World Cup was happening in South Africa that year, and I wanted an opportunity to go down there and be a part of the action. And for me, I've always been less interested in the main news event than in the sort of human interest that's happening, you know, on the periphery. And so that's very much what I did in South Africa. I was fortunate enough to get an opportunity to do some work with the Wall Street Journal, as well as with GQ magazine, across short documentary films, writing, photography. And it was really, I spent just about 2 months in South Africa doing everything from looking at the cultural and tourism impact on South Africa to going into the slums and reporting on the impact or lack thereof that they were seeing from the World Cup. And so really, if you look at the themes of my career, really focusing on the underdog, focusing on that sort of untold, underreported angle has always been really crucial for me and what's driven me. And thankfully, that's what I've gone into with narratively. After being in South Africa, I came back and did some freelance work with Univision Interactive Media, and then was able to get connected with the New York Times, which really became a definitive period in my life. Just for about 2 years, I was essentially full-time freelancing for the New York Times, started stringing, you know, really that kind of low totem pole, clawing your way to the top through freelance reporting, you know, being the eyes and the ears at news events, but then very quickly was able to start pitching and writing my own feature stories, eventually started doing some documentary film work for them, you know, short form kind of, you know, video work. I was lucky enough to have a photograph of mine land on the front page at one point. Mm-hmm. So we really had this incredible experience, but through it all, I couldn't stop thinking about this idea that I had developed for what would become narratively. And really, I was driven, Shamath, because in the media landscape, I've always thought that the human interest story, you know, sort of the humble feature story, as it's sometimes known, is often not given a fair shake. It's relegated to the back pages of a magazine or a newspaper or nowadays a digital outlet. And I thought that these are the types of stories that, sure, while they didn't necessitate being on the top of an evening newscast or the front page of the New York Times necessarily, these were stories that could potentially have a big impact. So I started collecting these ideas in my back pocket that I wanted to tell, but really had no outlet for because they weren't newsy enough, or they were too edgy, or they were too emotional, too sophisticated, whatever it might be. And ultimately, I started meeting other journalists while on assignment for the New York Times. I might be covering a fire scene in the Bronx in the middle of the night and turn to the journalist next to me from the Daily News and say, hey, I have stories I care about telling and I have no place to tell them. I know you do too. Let's sit down and chat and maybe we can build something. And very quickly, I started getting other journalists and storytellers together from New York to share these passion projects, these richly human narratives that they were not able to get published anywhere else or didn't even think to because they didn't fit into the constraints of the mainstream media news landscape. And very quickly, these meetings of ours grew from 2 to 6 to 8 to 12 to 20 to 50 to 80 to, you know, by the time we would launch narratively, we had 100 journalists squeezing into a room talking about stories. So that's sort of the background. Obviously, we can get into kind of how that all came to be. But I guess to sum up, you know, I've spent my career working in virtually every corner of the media landscape, from broadcast, news and documentaries and reality to community journalism and newspapers to foreign language media with Univision to ultimately big mass media like the New York Times and GQ, Wall Street Journal, and others. So, and then of course now through Narratively, it's a whole other, you know, window into the world. And as you alluded in your intro, Shamans, you know, we're doing work with Hollywood now. So it's really been an interesting evolution for me and having a lot of fun throughout the process.
Wonderful. Yeah. And it sounds like a lot of what you ended up doing at Narratively had its seeds in the kind of journalism that you were always interested in what you described as the stories of the underdog and stories that not a lot of other outlets would publish. And when you launched Narratively in 2012, you had a focus completely on New York and you emphasized long-form stories. Now, those seem like two elements that seem like an unlikely combination. It's like local news, long-form news, and human interest stories. And you did say you were hearing from other journalists that you met that they had all these stories that they wanted to tell. I'm curious, though, did you do any sort of market research as to the kind of demand there could have been for stories like this, considering this was a juxtaposition of elements that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see together?
Great question. So yeah, I guess there's two answers to that question. And essentially there were two types of market research. There was the sort of everyday, just kind of casual conversations that I was always having with fellow journalists and storytellers and lovers of nonfiction, which again, you know, were happening over beers and bars or coffees or just over while waiting for a news story to break, you know, on assignment for the New York Times. I was always engaging in these conversations with people, and without fail, I was hearing, oh my gosh, yeah, this is a no-brainer. This makes perfect sense. Yes, I have these stories that I too want to tell, and they don't quite fit into the rigid requirements of my traditional media job right now. So absolutely. And so that for me was a validation. Okay, at least there's interest from other storytellers here. And then on the flip side, I did more methodical market research where I was just looking at, you know, demographic data from other publications out there. And as you said, Shamans, in the early days, we were only New York focused. So I was looking at, you know, data that was available online for oftentimes in the media kits from Gothamist or WNYC, New York Times, other publications that, you know, had at least some focus on New York City, just to kind of start to paint a picture of who I might try to reach. Ultimately, I ended up having, you know, putting out a survey and having a series of probably several dozen phone conversations with people that I knew, but were not journalists themselves. We're just readers of all stripes, all ages, from locations all across the U.S., I think even abroad. And so that too kind of helped start to paint the picture. But I would say that, you know, the market research happened in stages, and ultimately we decided to do a Kickstarter campaign in September 2012. And for me, that was perhaps the best form of validation and market research we could have asked for, because we put out this idea. You know, I think we did a good job in telling our story. After all, we were journalists and storytellers. If we couldn't tell our story well, who could? We started to get some early press prior to the Kickstarter. And then once the Kickstarter went live, we ended up getting pledges from 803 backers around the world, which was an incredible validation of what we were doing, and people were excited about it. But then more important than that, we started hearing from readers and writers around the world saying, hey, oh my gosh, I love what you're doing. It's so needed. This is crucial. Good luck to you guys. Oh, and by the way, when are you going to launch in Paris? When are you going to launch in Seattle or San Francisco or London? And so right away we thought, oh, we always had aspirations to grow beyond New York. And the idea was to grow city by city and eventually have a network of 10 or 20, you know, different cities around the world. But I think that outpouring of support we got early on from readers and from writers globally reminded us, or maybe not even reminded, but I think just kind of underscored this notion that the stories that we're interested in telling are universal. You don't need to live in New York to appreciate a story about a, you know, 98-year-old tugboat captain who's been working in New York Harbor for 70 years. You can live in Des Moines, Iowa. You can live in Paris. These are richly human stories that speak to our belonging in the world and our understanding of the world. And so that right there kind of signals us that, okay, you know, let's try to start thinking early on about how we can make this thing feel more global. And then, yeah, within 6 months, that's just what we did. We ended up, you know, early on was 100% New York stories. And the idea was slow storytelling. So just publishing one story a day under a weekly theme. And then within 6 months or so, we had started to sort of expand beyond that. And I think early on, we introduced one of our 5 weekly stories as a non-New York story. And then within, call it 9 months, we would sort of 50-50, you know, 50% New York, 50% non-New York too. And I think within a year and a couple of months after launching, it was probably reversed. You know, maybe only one story a week was New York and the rest were coming from across the world. And I think that was important. On the one hand, we had built a really loyal audience in New York. And so sometimes I wonder what would have happened had we maintained that New York niche while simultaneously expanding globally and building almost a separate product. But hey, we didn't do that. We opted to go globally early on. And as a result, the audience is truly global today. We have about 65-70% of our audience comes from the US and the rest comes from global. But hey, having 33% of our audience come internationally is, I think, a pretty healthy sign of a very global platform.
Yeah. And I think the phrase that jumped out to me was slow storytelling. And it's something that not a lot of people think can have a lot of resonance. But certainly narratively through the early days of the Kickstarter campaign to today. And I think it's one of the things that it's proven for me as I've watched it grow and evolve is that slow storytelling certainly can have a resonance, certainly can have a broad-based appeal, even if it's not through like known publications like The New Yorker. You know, just to also stay at that that time in your chronology when you launch your Kickstarter campaign, the Kickstarter raised about $53,000, not a lot of money by any standards, and you guys weren't monetizing narratively at that point of time. So what were your plans for using this $53,000, and what were your plans at the time for when this $53K would run out?
Yeah, so for starters, our goal was 50. So we exceeded the goal. Right. And you're right. To launch a media company, $53,000 is not a lot of money, but maybe it was a sign of the challenges that we're facing journalism in those days. And of course, even more so today, because it was deemed a major success. You know, there was a lot of press around the fact that, oh my gosh, these guys are saving journalism. You know, people are willing to support it. You know, certainly we didn't raise the millions that some of the more kind of, you know, Pebble smartwatch and some of those products that came out around that same time had raised. But I think that was an indication that there was excitement and energy for what we're doing. The early business model that I had mapped out was that we would generate revenue through subscriptions, through ticketed events, through advertising. And the reality is that early on, we realized that generating revenue through those streams would probably not be the revenue streams that would sustain us. And the reason for that is, I think it's fairly simple. I mean, for starters, getting people to pay for something online is sadly very challenging. I think we're starting to see that change nowadays. But if you look at some of the products, the media news products that consumers are willing to pay for, these are highly scaled products. These are highly niche products, whether it's a Spotify, which obviously is not niche, but very scaled, or a Financial Times, which is very niche, but people are willing to pay a premium to have access to information that they can make money off of, or they can make choices off with. Narratively, hey, listen, I think that our storytelling is vital and should be required reading, but the reality is that, you know, it's really not the case. You don't need to read narratively to know what's happening in the world. It certainly does inform your sense of what it means to be a human being, but you don't need to have our product. And so we have thought over the about, you know, experimenting with a paywall, and that's very much something we still continue to think about and might want to try out sometime down the line. But we realized that, you know, generating revenue from subscriptions could be challenging. I think generating revenue from advertising could be even more challenging, because in order to do so, you need to reach, you know, millions and millions of readers. In order to do that, you oftentimes have to dumb down your content, which we never wanted to sacrifice. You know, really, for us, quality is paramount. We really have always optimized, you know, for authenticity and really creating stories that we feel are meaningful and refreshing and organically told and not something that you can find anywhere else. But, you know, I think the publications that have subsisted off of advertising for many years either were the major media publications that were doing so through print, which of course is starting to dwindle, or they're doing it through online ads, which still to this day are, you know, relatively low rates and weren't what they were in the print heyday for advertising. So it's a challenging model, which is why a lot of the major media outlets out there, even some from this later generation that started in the past 5-10 years, have either folded or downsized or had massive layoffs or done down rounds from investors because they just haven't been able to achieve the sky high valuations that they had mapped out initially. Whereas we've never fallen to that trap. And so for us, what really early on, what became clear to us is that beyond building a platform with really high quality content driven by high quality storytellers, journalists, and editors was this talent network we were building. There's a lot of value in this network of content creators. And now, certainly, but even then in 2012, 2013, in our early days, there was a major appetite for content creation, for branded content, for content marketing, you want to call it. And so early on, we started hearing from a couple of other outlets that had an interest in potentially hiring narratively to produce content for them. I think it was, in fact, it was one outlet that reached out to us, and we never, the opportunity never really panned out, but that planted the seed in my mind that, hey, we've built something really valuable here. You know, let me see if I can find other possible customers that, you know, might benefit from Narrative.ly's way, you know, our sort of authentic style of higher quality storytelling. And sure enough, we started, every time I would meet someone who worked in marketing or in media or branding or for an agency who I thought might have a need for freelance content creation support, I would ask them and I would start to share the Narrative.ly story. And that story, of course, evolved over time, but we were lucky enough that within, I think, 5 or 6 months of launching, we signed a very large contract with a nonprofit to produce writing-based sort of education tools. You know, this is a kind of a literacy nonprofit that was using kind of reading comprehension as a means to connect with students and enrich and educate students. But they were frustrated that the quality of the reading materials that they were giving to their students were a bit outdated and not very engaging. So they essentially commissioned Narrative.ly to produce hundreds, close to 1,000 of these pieces of content, which, you know, to be clear, had little to do with what we were building at Narrative.ly, other than the fact that we were doing high quality content creation, original ideas, that we were leveraging this network we were building. But it certainly wasn't content that we would publish on Narrative.ly.com, which in those days was Narrative.ly. That was our old URL. But that was work, and that was a way for us to sort of direct the profits from those types of clients into our core operation, which essentially helped us keep the lights on for those early days. And over time, the division of Narrative.ly through which we produce brand or client facing content creation, much of it white labeled, meaning that you don't see Narrative.ly's name attached to it. It doesn't live on our platform. It lives on the client's platforms or social or other channels. That became, to this day, it's the largest revenue stream of Narrative.ly, although thankfully as we've grown, we now have other streams as well, which I can get into in a second. But you know, Narrative.ly Creative is what we call that part of the business. And we've gone on to work with brands ranging from Amazon to GE to Contently to 23andMe, Tribeca Studios, CIBC, which is a major Canadian bank. A lot of these really formative brands and nonprofits like the Beer Institute for Justice, like the National Forest Foundation, that are doing really amazing work, and we can help them spread their message, connect with customers and constituents in really powerful ways through really meaningful storytelling. So that became a really the biggest revenue stream for us, and I think for a reason, because Narrative.ly was differentiating ourselves from the competition through Narrative.ly.com, through our storytelling, and that became a magnet for talent, for storytellers, for partners, for clients, and to this day, it remains a really powerful driver of engagement across the Narrative.ly brand. So that's kind of, you know, revenue stream number one. Revenue stream number two has become Narrative.ly Studios, which is what we call our Hollywood-facing kind of production division. And we were fortunate to sign a deal with Warner Brothers Television about a year and a half ago, essentially granting them access to the library of Narrative.ly stories for projects that Narrative.ly would develop and produce with them as a true producer and production company. And so that's been a really interesting opportunity for us. We've over the years, and that originated, by the way, because we had been hearing for years from production companies, from talent agencies, cable networks, studios, you name it, interested in our stories and saying, oh my gosh, have you ever thought about adapting this story into a feature film or into a TV series or into a documentary? And we got so much of an interest that ultimately we ended up signing an agreement with a talent agency called APA, which started representing us about 2 years ago. And the first order of business with them was getting to know all these different Hollywood players to explore different partnerships, and met with a number of people across town. And Warner Bros. Just seemed like a really good fit. They were already big fans of Narratively. They didn't really have another intellectual property partner like Narratively, other than a couple companies like DC Comics and Ally Media that they had partnered with years prior and actually acquired. So we were very unique in the sense that we were bringing this catalog of humanity to them, which of course, each of our stories could form or could become a launching pad for fictitious and nonfiction projects across TV and film. And so fast forward to now, a year and a half later, we have about a dozen different projects in development. I can't get details just yet, but we had a very, very successful trip to Hollywood about a week and a half ago, where we actually sold a script, which I'll hopefully be able to report on pretty soon. But we're, the good thing is that we're getting projects going. It's taken a beat to sort of figure out how we can best provide value there and how to connect with people and make things happen the right way. But I think we've started to really figure it out now, and things are falling into place really nicely.
Yeah. And I find all of that very fascinating, just because your revenue and monetization model seems so dramatically different from most journalism outlets out there. Certainly some of the newer outlets may have some parallels with what you're doing, but certainly you guys were pioneers in terms of having a monetization model that avoided many of the pitfalls that is leading to the demise of a lot of traditional journalism. I am curious, though, Noah, when you have, let's just say, the Narratively branded content arm and the studio arm, right? How much of your work for, let's just say, your brand clients or the studios, how much of that work is contingent on the traffic numbers you hit on the Narratively.com site? Do they care? Because it sounds to me like a lot of the monetization initiatives subsidize the creative work on Narratively.com, and even though the same pool of talent helps produce the branded content and the studio work, I would imagine it's the success of the Narratively.com that's actually triggering the interest in the branded side. Can you speak to what the interdependence looks like in terms of Narratively.com and some of your monetization initiatives?
It's a really great question, Samath, and something we think about a lot. And to be honest, we've struggled with for a while. For a long time, we said, this is years ago, our hearts have always been in Narratively.com, in the platform, and building that and getting it to a point that it deserves to be at. But throughout, as you said and I've said, revenue has come from other places. So for a long time, we struggled with almost this existential crisis of why does Narratively.com exist? If we just wanted to create a creative agency, we'd be paying ourselves a lot more. We would, but frankly, that's not what we've wanted to do. What we've sort of come to learn and embrace over the years is, none of this other stuff would exist if it weren't for Narratively.com, for the main sort of platform. And the reasons for that are fairly simple. The first is that we wouldn't be working with Hollywood right now if we didn't have a library of immensely powerful and super unique and engaging human stories that we could use as inspiration to partner with Hollywood. So even though we're not monetizing the site directly through ads or subscriptions or even live events, we've dabbled in events, by the way, but haven't done a lot and certainly haven't raised a lot of money through events. But even though we haven't directly monetized it, this library and this network of talent we're creating is certainly driving what we do in a really meaningful and cool and fun way with Hollywood and with Madison Avenue on the branded and sort of client-facing side. If we didn't have Narrative.com in the first place, we wouldn't have attracted this network of storytellers with whom we're now working to create projects that are really beneficial to Hollywood. And likewise, the early content creators that we were working with for our brand partners were folks that came to Narratively.com initially to create journalism and other projects, you know, non-branded projects. So there's definitely that kind of a synergy. We've really come to think of narrowly.com nowadays in 2019 as a magnet. It's a, you know, sure, maybe in a certain extent, it's a loss leader in the sense that, you know, this is our sort of crown jewel. And that's changing, by the way, too. You know, we're starting to think of narrowly.com as less of like the main quote unquote thing we do and more as, hey, here's one really special entry point into the Narrowly brand. But if in a year or 2 years, you as a consumer are discovering Narrowly for the first time through a TV series we have with HBO or through a podcast we have with Luminary, and you don't really know or care that we run this storytelling platform, Narrowly.com, like I don't know that I really care. You know, I just want to be able to connect with you to share these incredible stories that I think the world needs to know about, to give them the credit they deserve, to give these storytellers the exposure and opportunities they deserve. I think it's a win-win. But what's happened in the past year and a half, 2 years, is that we've really started to prioritize only working with clients that are interested in tapping into this human-centric storytelling that we try to do across the board. And out of that strategy has come some really meaningful work. For example, we've been doing a short-form branded travel documentary series with a big Canadian bank for the past year plus. We're going on, I think, 12 or 15 films for them. Those films have won a Telly Award for Best Branded Documentary Series. We've gone on now to do more work from them across different formats. And so, you know, and this is very character-driven, true, really refreshing storytelling that feels very connected back to the main Narrowly brand and to our storytelling platform, Narrowly.com. Likewise, we did a really cool series with Tribeca Studios, which is the production arm of Tribeca Film Festival, and their partner 23andMe, the genetics company. And in that series, which was called Identity, 23andMe pretty ingeniously commissioned 23 films from filmmakers exploring issues of identity and genetics. And I actually wrote and directed and produced one of the short films. Our in-house lead director, producer, Apola, directed another. And my film was a film called The Story of Your Name. It was kind of a love letter to my son, who's now 15 months old, about where his name came from, because he was named after this distant four times great uncle who had this incredible larger than life story. So point being, the fact that we're now doing work for our clients and our brand partners that feels very story driven, feels intensely personal and emotional, I think is showing that we're moving in the right direction. And that I think for us, I think we're at our best and our finest and most effective when we're doing storytelling that a lot of the rest of the world is ignoring or is relegating to sort of the back pages or the depths of the internet. And we're really spotlighting it front and center, understanding that there is a this magnetic effect to the underdog. There are people, everyone wants to root for the underdog. And I think in many ways, that's what Narrowly is too. You know, we've been this, you know, relatively smaller media company that's trying to do things different that I think some people have credited us with coining the term slow storytelling back in the day, which I don't know if we can take that credit. But point being, you know, we launched at a time when the whole internet was so focused on this kind of Twitterification of content, small bites of content, this constant conversation, this constant buzzing in your ear, which, yeah, there is a place for that to a certain extent. But I think in that sort of a climate, a lot of these important stories were, and these sort of quieter, seemingly quieter stories on their surface, at least, were being left untold. And so that's where Narrowly found our opening, and we're still moving forward.
Wow. Yeah. And, you know, it's amazing. Even the branded content, as you described, can be so personal, much like the movie you spoke of about your son's naming. If someone who saw that movie wouldn't guess that it's branded, so to speak, or in some circles, branded can almost be a dirty word, but I think the way you speak of it speaks to how branded content can be made tastefully and in a way with human interest stories in a way that can actually be serving your business needs as well as have a journalistic angle to it. And I think that's amazing.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. Also, just when you put these stories out, what, if any, are some of the things that are responsible for spreading the word about some of these stories on narratively.com. Right. So how do you guys get traffic? Presumably, it's not just publishing it on narratively.com and just waiting. Maybe that is it. I don't know. What happens?
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely, some of it is certainly what we're grateful that over 7 years of operation now, we have built a ultra loyal audience that does still come direct to our site. So that's certainly a part of it. We've built up a pretty robust base of newsletter subscribers. So we send, I believe right now we send 4 newsletters out. I'm always thinking about new newsletter products and things we can share. So that's definitely become a really fun and powerful tool for us. Beyond newsletters, we do get significant traffic from a lot of the aggregators out there still. And that's sort of a blanket term. I would include under that term even sites like Google, people searching for something and stumbling upon our article and coming our way. So obviously Google search isn't really aggregating our content, but featuring it. Likewise, dig.com has been thankfully really good to us, and they love to feature really powerful, longer form content from across the web. Pocket.com, again, is just as great, and they've become a really successful driver of traffic for Narratively. And then you occasionally will syndicate or excerpt stories of ours with other publications. And in some cases, we're syndicating that content in full, in which case there's generally a fee on doing so, as well as links to Narratively content, which does drive some traffic. Obviously, if the story is merely excerpted and we're only publishing a small part of it on another publisher. Good example is we had our biggest story of all time in terms of page views, but also I would say average read time was probably up there as our best of all time as well. It was an article called The Man with the Golden Airline Ticket. And it was written by an old time contributor of ours named Caroline Rothstein, beautiful piece, long form. And within 6 hours of publishing on our site, it broke our record of our most read piece of all time. And then about a month and a half later, we syndicated that story with The Guardian. And I think within 13 hours, it became The Guardian's most read long read of all time. So that just shows that when you seed Narratively content on these larger, arguably more impactful in terms of reach platforms, great things can happen. So I think that's something we're starting to think more about is like, are there, whether it's at The Guardian or
yeah. How did that happen? Do you guys
talk that I'm always doing business development and form relationships. So in the early days, a lot of our kind of syndication partnerships with Salon.com, for example, or TheWeek.com, Dig.com, I think as well, originated because I had, met people in form relationships and then we kept growing those. I think with The Guardian, I want to say that they might've just reached out to us. And that's happened many times, really, where other outlets reach directly out to us and say, hey, listen, we love your work. Are you interested in republishing with us? And how can we work together? And we've done it over the years with Refinery29, with Vox, with a handful of other publications, or more than a handful, probably a couple dozen, and to various successes. And I think, again, the key is figuring out, like, if you're just giving someone an article and they're not driving meaningful traffic back to you and they're not paying for it, like, what's the point? But I think if you're able to monetize with them and or get them to drive significant traffic your way, then I think you're working on something. So that's been interesting for us. And I think that sort of an off-platform strategy, call it a distributed strategy, I think can also be relevant in podcasting. We publish or create a podcast with Luminary or Spotify or iHeartMedia or Audible, and that content lives within that platform's walled garden. But I think that's great because they have spent years in some cases building these ultra loyal audiences who come to their platforms expecting to be entertained and inspired and enlightened. And I think if we can be a part of that and A, get credit as the publisher and B, get paid for it and C, build our brand along the way, that's a win-win. Likewise with Hollywood, it's not like narratively.com can compete with HBO or Netflix or CBS at this point for eyeballs. So we'd be, I think, foolish to not, if we want to create a TV show and have it air with one of those networks or platforms, and again, get paid for it and have our brand be a part of the journey, and the attention and exposure and hopefully accolades, like that's great. I don't feel the need to sort of build at least right now, to build this video streaming platform to compete with Netflix. I think that's an uphill battle at this stage. But I think if we can partner with those people and leverage their funding streams, their audience, their technology, their product people, their marketing, their awards pushes. Like, that's a great scenario for us.
Yeah. And what I find impressive is you took what would originally have seemed like a passion project, right? And I think you used that phrase to refer to at least some of the early writers who were writing about these things that they found cool and interesting that wasn't necessarily mainstream. But now it almost seems like a lot of the mainstream outlets are wanting to pick up a lot of these stories that they find interesting and compelling because they're finding that some of these articles can drive page views, they can drive traffic, they can drive eyeballs, and which I think is fascinating, as you described, an age of Twitterification of journalism. Yeah. And Noah, very many ways that you talked about in which you've basically rewritten a lot of the rules just around monetizing journalism. You guys have found your own path in very many ways. What would you describe as some of the more challenging phases for Narratively during its evolution, if at all they existed? If not, you have to say that too.
Oh, no, they definitely have existed. And I'm not shy to share. I think it's very important to be open-minded and transparent with respect to sharing the highs and the lows. I think part of the reason for being in this business, I think, is to inspire others to try to make their mark. And I think we're at a very pivotal time right now in media and content creation, entertainment, where there's a lot of new players emerging, but there's also and new business models and economics, but there's also new challenges. So I think it's really crucial to have those conversations. So I think the challenges are many. I mean, for starters, since we launched, we've been trying to build something that, at least in the early days, people told us we shouldn't be building. A lot of early investors that we had talked to, and by the way, we've barely taken any money on. We decided at a certain point that we wanted to forge our own path. We truly believed in what we were doing, and I think the results speak for themselves. But in the early days, we were entertaining conversations with investors. A lot of those folks were saying, oh, you know what? This is back in 2013, 14, maybe in 15. We only invest in tech companies. You know, I think companies can't make money. They're too risky. Thankfully, we're in this era now where content is king, and I think rightfully so. And I think you have to be wise about the type of content you're creating and the economics around it and the marketing distribution of it. But I think, you know, with the right model that I think everyone's trying to figure out, I think you can really be impactful and sustainable. So in 7 years of operation, we've only raised $25,000 in investment. And that was from a strategic investor who was actually a former AOL CEO named John Miller, who we really admired, who admired us. And this is back in 2014, just wanted to kind of get him in our corner and be able to sort of pick his brain. So that was, you know, that was it. And I think that was, you know, I think the big reason for not pursuing more investors was that we were hearing that same thing that, oh, you want you guys to have a big tech component. You should build your own CMS. You should do this, do that. And we said, no, we really want to invest in content because that's how we can truly differentiate ourselves. We can't compete with the Netflixes and other platforms with respect to technology, at least at this point, nor do we feel we need to. So as a result of being a 99.999% bootstrapped company, there have been some challenges inherent in that model. You know, there were times over the years, thankfully, those are behind us, when cash flow was tight and we had to land a new client or a new source of revenue quickly or else we might be in some trouble. Thankfully, we always did. We're always pushing, always working hard, and I think always believing in our model, always believing that we were truly providing something that was valuable and needed in the world. And I think that drove us to a large extent. But that's been challenging. I think, and likewise, I think most of the challenges can be traced back to money. When you don't have a ton of resources, you know, sometimes hiring can be a challenge. You know, how do you attract the best talent when you're only able to pay them 60% of what they could be getting in a larger company? And again, thankfully, we're I think behind those challenges too. But those certainly kind of created some challenges along the way. And now I think there's a flip side though too. I think because we've, you know, always been bootstrapped, we've never had the luxury of having seemingly bottomless resources to go out and experiment and try new things. So with that in mind, we've had to be laser focused on what we thought was our core competency. And now it doesn't mean that we haven't tried new things. I mean, if anything, one of our other challenges has been perhaps trying other things too quickly. But I think We haven't, for example, when everyone was like investing in Vine video production team, short form video, whoever it was 5-6 years ago, and building whole teams devoted to it, like we never had that luxury. And then when Vine went kaput a couple of years after that, like we didn't have the same impact other people did because we had never tried it in the first place. So I think, yeah, there's that level of, listen, hindsight's always great. It's nice to be able to say, oh, you know, because of our challenges, we were able to sort of, you know, not make the same mistakes. And I think, listen, we also, one of our benefits is that we have always been lean, and that's been, you know, largely by necessity. But when you hear about some of the major digital media companies that are either going belly up or laying off 100, 500, 1,000 people, we've never been in that situation because we've always really been, had to be super careful about every hire we make, making sure everyone we bring on needs to be one of those first people in the room with us. And I think it's been a good run. I think another challenge we faced along the way, and again, I think this is starting to change too, and you know, has been slowly changing over the years, is that the type of content we create is a lot of consumers and other media companies can't quite figure out like where it fits in. And I think when it comes to sort of marketing and, you know, distributing narratives content across other platforms, and also, you know, signaling to readers and listeners and viewers like when they should spend time with us, when they should make the time in their daily or weekly or monthly consumption habit for Narratively, that has sometimes been a challenge because it's not like, and I'm the first to admit, I'm the founder of Narratively, and when I wake up in the morning, it's not like going to narratively.com is the first thing I do. My first thing I do is listen to NPR for a bit, and then I listen to Up First, the podcast, which is the daily NPR news podcast. Then I maybe flip through the New York Times a little bit on the app on my phone. But I lately have been listening to, we actually now have audio versions of all of our new stories in which we have professional narrators reading aloud the latest Narratively story. And so that for me has been a godsend because now while I'm doing dishes at night after my baby has gone to bed, I can pop in my headphones and catch up on Narratively, or I can, you know, listen on the subway, or I can save some stories to pocket and read them on my commute. So I think it's about, I think we haven't, one of our challenges has been kind of really, you know, to recap that, figuring out like the best way to get our content in front of people and how and when and where. But I also think that like everyone's different. And I think, you know, there's so many new tools out there, not to mention new platforms we can experiment with that can help us try to figure that out.
Right. Yeah. And it's by no means a smooth and steady ride, but here you are. And I think you've basically redefined a lot of how journalism is done, how long-form journalism is done, and I'm excited for what lies ahead for you guys. And I know we are coming up on time, and I think this is a good time for us to start to wrap up. Could you tell us, Noah, briefly, what are some of the things you're excited about going forward?
I'd be happy to, Shamat. So, you know, I think what Narratively wants to become, and we're on our way, is this formidable, you know, media and production company that I think is doing really different, unique, and powerful, engaging work. Maybe it's work that you haven't really seen before. It's hard to classify. In many respects, we are sort of this Frankensteinian hybrid of a media platform / talent network / production company / creative agency. And I think that's why we're so cool and effective and why we've always been that magnet, as I mentioned earlier, Shamant, for talent, for partners, for great storytelling, because that's what drives us at the end of the day. And I think I won't stop until I feel like we've really reached our true potential in terms of, and I think for me, a big litmus test is when I go into one of these meetings in Hollywood, for example, or into a meeting with a brand, or for that matter, meet someone at a party and I tell them what I do, and they say, oh my gosh, that is amazing. And then they see the stories and say, oh my God, these stories are incredible. Like, how have I not discovered you before? And to me, that's always that's like a respect. It's a good thing to hear because it shows, oh, these people are excited and they think what we're doing is really special. But the other side, it's kind of like, well, like, why the heck haven't you heard about us yet? Like, what can we be doing to reach these people? Because these are people that should be our core audience, and they don't know about us yet. I guess one last thing I want to say, too, I know this is a question you had earlier, Shamant, that we didn't get to, was, you know, Narratively started as, you know, presumably as this passion project. But I think the thing that I want, you know, your listeners to come away from is that, you know, yes, while this has always been driven by my passion, by the passion of my editors and producers and strategists and storytellers, I never once had the thought or plan that this would be a short-lived thing. I wouldn't be doing it and would have dedicated my life to it if I didn't think this truly could become a impactful and highly scalable thing that could impact people across so many different levels. And I think one of the other benefits of sort of not raising money is that we've had, you know, again, there have been challenges, but I think one of the blessings is that, you know, it's taken us a while to sort of figure it out. And I think we've been on, I mean, if you look at Vice and not to compare ourselves to them, and you know, Vice has its own challenges and, you know, issues these days. But if you think about the fact that Vice started as a print, you know, punk magazine back in like the early or mid 90s, and it wasn't until 10, 12, 15 years later that like the world really kind of came to know who they were, and they really took that world by storm. I think it's a good reminder that, like, and that was a different era, of course, but I think there were benefits in Vice being able to sort of spend that length of time really building an identity and building a community and an audience and network of creators. And I think narratively, in our own very different way than Vice, to be clear, is doing something similar, where we've had to kind of spend time figuring out where the best opportunities are, how do we get there? And I think now that we have that vision, I think other opportunities are falling into place in a really, really powerful way. And I think, you know, really excited for what the next year and beyond brings us.
Yeah. And I'm very excited to see what comes ahead for Narratively Noah. And I think the fact that you built something that can be described as hard to classify can also be such a great sign that you built something truly unique, something truly distinctive. And that's certainly been my experience of Narratively thus far. And I can't wait to see where you guys go from here.
Appreciate it. You've been a stakeholder since the beginning. I mean, you were one of our early contributors. So it's really meaningful for me to come back 7 years later and have this conversation with you. I appreciate your time and your thoughtful question.
Indeed, we've come full circle in many ways. And I'm excited to see what lies ahead. Thank you so much for taking the time to be on How Things Grow.
My pleasure, Samant. Talk to you soon.
Absolutely, sir.
Hey guys, this is Shamant again. Before you go, I have a small but very important favor to ask. If you get any pleasure or inspiration from this episode, could you please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform, be it iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix? This podcast is very much a labor of love. It makes no money, and each episode takes many, many hours to put together. When you leave a rating or write a review, it not only means a great deal of encouragement to me, but it also supports getting the word out about How Things Grow. Thank you again for listening, and I look forward to seeing you with the next episode. Thank you.